Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today we'll hear a panel discussion on the topic, A Touch of Local Caring, Haitian Earthquake Relief. The members of the panel, from Creighton University Medical Center and the University of Nebraska Medical Center, recently returned from Haiti after spending time there providing medical support to the victims, will be from Creighton, Brian Logge, Professor of Surgery, and Tommy Lee, Assistant Professor of Surgery. From the University of Nebraska, Oloyemzi Odugbezan, Instructor of Anesthesiology, and Alan Richards, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology and Head and Neck Surgery. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 15, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Willis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
A massive 7.0 magnitude earthquake hit 10 miles west of Port-au-Prince, Haiti, with a population of nearly 2 million inhabitants. The mayor of Port-au-Prince estimated that about 60% of the buildings were poorly constructed and unsafe in normal conditions, which added to the devastation. Dr. Brian Logge, Professor of Surgery, Dr. Tommy Lee, Assistant Professor of Surgery from Creighton Medical Center, and Dr. Yemi Odubisan, a UNMC Instructor of Anesthesiology, and Dr. Alan Richards, Associate Professor of Head and Neck Surgery from the University of Nebraska Medical Center, are here today to discuss the rescue efforts in Haiti. Dr. Logge, if you'd like to start.
Sure. Well, what a beautiful day. As I was coming over here, I was wondering what would happen here if we had an earthquake like that. And I can assure you that that even if all of our hospitals collapsed, it would be a completely different scenario. The earthquake, I'm a surgical oncologist, in case you're wondering. I'm a cancer surgeon. I'm not a disaster junkie. I'm not a trauma surgeon. I don't go out of my way to try to organize responses to disasters. But what happened here that was different to me was the earthquake in Haiti was on a Tuesday, I think about 4:53 in the afternoon. And so we started on the news getting some information at the end of that day, and then some more information trickled out on the Wednesday. The devastation was so severe, the infrastructure changes so severe, that there was very little news that came out initially. But it was apparent. I had been down to another earthquake many, many years ago, but it was apparent that from what they were describing, a lot of 1, 2, and 3-story buildings were devastated in this. And the implication for me was that when you talk about casualties in an earthquake, there are two kinds of casualties. One is people that are crushed and dead, and then the other are people that are injured. And you can have, if everybody's dead, they don't need a doctor, not to put too fine on a point on a pencil, but if you have a lot of people that are injured, that does require, obviously, a response. And it sounded like there was going to be an enormous toll in terms of injuries and then an inability to mount any kind of an effective response. And the reason that I got involved is that our university, Creighton University, runs a mission down in Santiago, the Dominican Republic. Been there for many years, run by, associated with the Jesuits. And I felt that it would actually make sense, based on the early news that we had, it sounded like Port-au-Prince, the airport, the port, the roads, infrastructure, hospitals basically would be shut down. And I thought that we at Creighton would have an advantage coming in through the back door, staging in a mission in a place in Santiago. And so Father Alexander, who's the Vice President of Ministry, and I talked, and he gave me the contact number for Father Bill Johnson, who's a Jesuit priest down at ILAC. And by serendipity, and the whole mission worked almost by serendipity, but he had just got off the phone with a priest in Himani, which is a border town in the Dominican Republic, about 30 clicks from Port-au-Prince. And the intelligence that he had on the ground was that there were a large number of injured people that were coming through the border at that point and seeking treatment. It wasn't clear what kind of a treatment response, clinics, hospitals, et cetera. And so with that information, we put together a semblance of a plan. The first part of the plan, though, was very, very Jesuit in its intent, and that was do something that nobody else is doing. And by virtue of the fact that we had that mission down there, it was something that we could do that other institutions almost anywhere in the United States basically couldn't do because they didn't have access to this resource. And so we began putting together the framework of a plan. That was on Thursday morning. So Wednesday we got some information. Thursday morning I received permission from Father Schlegel to form a MedSurg response team. And I gave myself 48 hours to have a team assembled, supplies assembled, and to be down in the Dominican Republic. I guess I'm not afraid of deadlines. But we basically did that. I invited people down. The invitations were a little strange. Would you like to come and help people in Haiti when you're leaving? We're leaving on Saturday morning. So this would be Thursday and Friday, talking to people where we're leaving either the day after tomorrow or tomorrow, depending on which day. When you're coming back, I don't know. Where are you going? I don't know. What are you going to do when you get there? I don't know. We were able to assemble a team by Friday at 3 p.m. was our drop dead. The earthquake was on Tuesday. And once the earthquake rumbles through, then for trauma, I mean, the clock is ticking, and we were very much aware of that. So by Friday at 3, we had our team together. The legal people at our university kind of read us the Riot Act, which I appreciated, and didn't scare anybody off. And they did so rightfully, because we're going into an unknown situation. The situation in Haiti before the earthquake was bad. Our university wanted us to stay in the Dominican Republic, if at all possible, and that actually made sense the way that we had constructed the mission. And so we actually did get supplies together. I was able to secure an airplane through CARE International, and we had a jet which is smaller than what they initially represented to us, but we had a 9-seat aircraft that would go directly from Epley Airfield down to Santiago. And so we grabbed that, and we wanted to have a private aircraft so that we could also load it to the gills with medical supplies. So we assembled a team of people on Friday and all of the supplies, and then headed down to Santiago. We were able to get through the border customs because that was facilitated by our mission, well known to the people and the customs people and the airport people there, and that was really important. And then we were actually able to assemble as a team, pull our equipment together, that we would need. And then the following morning, got on an ILAC bus with Father Johnson and made our way to Himani. But anyway, when we got to the town of Himani, there was a little hospital there. Himani has an interesting history. Their river overflowed a few years ago, and about half the people in that town, several thousand people, died, drowned. The hospital in town was very chaotic. We actually moved on outside of town to a small clinic called the Good Samaritan. And there were a couple of buildings that we were able to use. A team was in place before us, the Puerto Ricans. We turned out to be one of the earliest teams down for the response. So we were down 5 days after the earthquake. And I can tell you that what we encountered, and I don't know what we expected necessarily. I mean, we expected something very, very bad. We encountered an enormous sea of need, of injured, really badly ill people. But we also encountered absolute chaos in terms of systems and trying to help people. And, of course, you're coming into an area where you had a small, country clinic, so to have hundreds, literally hundreds of patients presenting at their door, you would expect some confusion. But the even as people arrived, there was chaos in the systems. And that was one of our first impressions, Tommy, that we had to do something about chaos. The chaos was literally killing people. And so a big part of what we had to do as a team was to figure out what to do with that. The first day was very, very terrible for all of us because as a physician, you go into the clinic, I've got a certain number of patients that are listed. At the end of the day, which could be a long day, I'm finished. I've looked after all my patients. Well, this was a tidal wave of people. There was no way to finish your list of patients. It was going to take several days, and all of us initially were inclined to just, you work until you drop. But that also isn't very effective. The person that really helped in that regard was the priest that came down with us. He had started chatting with the folks that were nominally running the clinic, found a place for us to stay. We brought tents and a generator. We thought we'd be sleeping in a field. They found a place for us to stay at a town, but it wasn't walking distance. We had to get on a bus and go if we were going to sleep and get some food. And so that actually meant that I pulled our team out as a team. We went back, and one of the best things that happened, and we continued that every single day after that, was to sit down and talk about what we encountered, what was going on, how we could fix it, and how we could address it. One of the first things that came out, I'm a surgeon, Tommy's a surgeon. We went down thinking we were going to be doctors. I mean, in the conventional sense of, you know, looking after wounds and cutting off limbs and things like that. We had enough doctors, if we got organized, that they could handle things like amputations. But what we encountered was that there was no organization to the flow of the hospital. There was no organization to the post-operative care, pre-operative care, logistics. We had a ward of patients sitting in an open-air chapel that rapidly filled up with 40, 50 acutely ill patients. And nobody to basically supervise or look after them. When Tommy and I looked, we were in a situation where it was not possible to do abdominal surgery or thoracic surgery, and most of those patients probably died before they got to the facility. So we all decided that we would wear whatever hats were needed depending upon what was the time. And so the hat that I wore was as a hospital administrator, and the hat that Tommy wore was to take over and run a medical ward. Tommy, you want
to? Yeah. Okay, so I'm just going to kind of build on what Dr. Logie's been saying for the last few minutes. So our mission, as you mentioned, was to respond to the Haitian quake from the Dominican Republic for a number of reasons. Infrastructure and safety is one. Maybe the more important reason is the Creighton affiliation with the ILAC Center, or the Institute for Latin American Concern, where Creighton had experience sending down people for various types of missions, including a hernia surgery mission, as well as orthopedic missions and other missions. So we had contacts, we had information, we had personnel, there was equipment down there. We had a means of getting into the area, but also finding out where the needs were, because without the ILAC Center, we would have never, ever known to go to Himani, or would have taken us more time. And I think, you know, anyone that we encountered in Himani, the same that were there at the same time as us or before us, I think almost uniformly had some kind of contact or inside track into the area. And that was really, I think, key to an early effective response, that people who just kind of wandered down needed an extra day or two to figure out where to go and what the situation was. So Himani, as we mentioned, is 30 miles from Port-au-Prince. So although it's not in Haiti, it is very close to Port-au-Prince and very close to the epicenter of the earthquake. Close enough that aftershocks in the original quake could be felt out there, but far away enough that I don't think that there was any major structural damage in the area, although there were some various cracks and so forth in our building, that in our hospital building, that made people a little bit nervous, but we were assured everything was okay. Our initial team was two surgeons, three nurse anesthesiologists, pediatrician, orthopedic PA, scrub tech, and OR nurse, and Father Bill Johnson from the ILAC Center joined us in the Dominican, and it really became kind of an ideal makeup for what we needed to do there. And it was meant to be a very versatile team, that we were ready to be in a self-sufficient surgical unit if that's what the need was, or we're able to blend in or fit in with the current needs at an already established site. So as Dr. Logie mentioned, on our arrival, it was chaos. And this was at the first community hospital in Himani, and it was a stack of coffins and a stack of water bottles, probably highlighting the two biggest needs or biggest things going on when we arrived. And it's the basic human necessities of something like water, and then the fact that there are a lot of people dying, even 5 days after the quake. It's a terrible shame. These are people who have survived the quake and have somehow made the 30-mile journey to Himani and have still, unfortunately, not made it. This is what you had to do. Everybody really had to put their head down and just do what needed to be done. We were all looking to help out, looking to do what we could. You had to get down right in there. You're doing your cast changes on the ground, right at the bedside. You did what you need to do, and you tried to be as efficient as possible. It was a real battle because as much as we were trying to do, our equipment was very limited, is we were able to do, you know, minor to moderately, you know, moderate orthopedic surgery, but people who had pelvic fractures, who had spinal fractures, burns, we just did not have the capability either in the OR or in the recovery phase to handle them, or people we thought had abdominal injuries that in a facility where we have no blood available, limited patient monitoring, limited fluids and all these sorts of things. We just did not have the resources to manage those types of patients, so it was very important and life-saving for us to transport them, and it was very frustrating at the start because we knew we had a population of patients that we really could not do much about and really needed to get them to get better care. But then we had an aftershock, a couple of moderately big aftershocks, and everything fell apart. All the patients panicked. Everybody went running out of their buildings, and all that organization seemed to go up in smoke all at once. And you see people out on the outside now. It happened in the early evening, and sort of chaos ensued again. Amazing thing here is as panic sort of stressed, kind of rose, a very sort of spiritual moment actually kind of developed, that people started to sing and to dance as sort of a way of calming themselves and trying to reassure themselves that everything was going to be okay. Things we learned, a few main points, set aside the ego, do what needs to be done. Like Dr. Logie said, neither of us did any surgery at all. We were just there to try to help out. You didn't want to, you know, be a part of the problem. You want to help fix it. Organization, absolutely important. You have no organization, you have, you know, poor communication, you get complications and mortality that compared to what was happening 100, 200 years ago. And then finally, the needs are in flux. That is, the phase of the operation changes. What we need changes, in particular, I see, you know, Matt's here in the audience, our pharmacist from Creighton University, and he just did phenomenal work, became an absolute key part of organizing what, I mean, you have all these drugs, but not one person knows what they all are. So, I mean, a pharmacist becomes a very obvious need, but something you totally would not think about before you got there. And I'll end there.
I'm Yemi Odugbesa. I'm from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And I had previously been to Haiti on missions before. And so when I heard about the earthquake, I think that, you know, everybody in Haiti can certainly remember what they were doing. I remember what I was doing at the time that I heard the earthquake. And my mind immediately went to all the friends and the wonderful relationships that I still had down there. So my initial thought was to try and contact the people that I knew, make sure that they were okay, and unfortunately did find some people who had lost family members. But my initial response in terms of what can I do, how can I help, my immediate thoughts were to go. And that was a similar response amongst probably over 75 initially people at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, because when the initial rallying call was put out at UNMC, we had a huge response. Again, you know, we don't know when we're going, we don't know where we're going, we don't know what we're going to do, we don't know when we'll be back, and we don't know what kind of situation we're going to encounter when we get down there. Is it going to be dangerous? What are we going to be dealing with? None of us knew, but we all answered that call, and initially we sent a team of 12 of us down. Five of us were physicians. We had two anesthesiologists, two trauma surgeons, and an orthopedic surgeon. And so when we initially landed in Port-au-Prince, it immediately became apparent that we were in the midst of a very, very dire situation. When people ask, what was it like? I say it was everything that you saw on the news and worse. Much like Hurricane Katrina, we encountered signs of people saying things like, you know, we need help, in English, in French, in Creole, in whatever language, in whatever manner they could put it up in. You know, they sent out the call that we definitely need help. So when we initially arrived, we sort of did an assessment of how we can best offer our services, where we can best be helpful. I ended up at a community hospital. There were some physicians that staffed a clinic run by Charlie Baker, and a number of us who went to University of Miami's MediShare, who it's a very large tent hospital that you can see from the air as you're arriving in Port-au-Prince, who still has a very large presence in Haiti today. And so Two things when we initially arrived were very apparent. How do we treat the injured, and how do we develop a coherent, cohesive system in order to be in order to deliver medical care? So we need systems, administrations, and we needed people to fulfill various roles. And much like any other medical member that went down there, you often find yourself wearing multiple hats, serving administrative roles, acting as nurses. I am an anesthesiologist, and I spent the least amount of time in the operating room where I was. I ran the wound care team because you have a tremendous amount of traumatic injuries, crush injuries, amputations that were treated surgically, but then you have to keep those wounds clean. And so that's what I ended up doing on my team. And then also, you know, to address the needs of not the immediate acute trauma needs, but also the chronic needs of people who are, millions of people who are now displaced and who have ended up in tent cities. You know, the kind of infectious diseases that they will encounter was something tremendous, especially now that we are in the height of the rainy season. With the several aftershocks, you found that people were very unwilling to stay indoors, even, you know, under the safety of a hospital that didn't fall in the initial quake. And so we had people all over the place inside of our hospital, and we also had people who needed less acute care who were in tent cities outside of our hospital. So I think that, you know, a lot of you guys have watched the news, and you've seen the kinds of situations that we encountered, the different roles that we played. So as we, you know, developed our hospital system and, came up with a cardiac system, a charting system, an organized way to bring patients to the OR, to the PACU, back to the floor, and then ultimately to discharge, throughout the time that we were there, as things became more organized, as the acute situation was addressed, we then found that life goes on. We had, you know, twins and triplets to deliver. We had general surgeries to do. We had appendectomies or appendixes to take out. We had, we started to function like a normal hospital and no longer as an acute trauma center. And so it became very apparent that the UNMC's response was not only, you know, immediate, but how do we continue to assist in Haiti getting back on its feet? How do we help the people best without necessarily coming and occupying their country? And so as we began to address the chronic medical concerns toward the end of our stay, you know, traumas due to motor vehicle accidents, gunshot wounds, those kind of things, we back home then began to think, our assistants back home began to think of, you know, how do we best assemble over 200 volunteers that we got. We had people on waiting lists willing to return to Haiti once we got back home. And so how do we best utilize those skills? You have more amputees in the nation of Haiti than you did American amputees in World War I. How do you begin to meet those needs? It's a very hilly country. People depend on their legs and arms for their livelihoods. How do you address the needs of the amputees? How do you address the post-traumatic needs? The one thing that I have all the pain meds I needed, but I didn't have the psychiatric know-how or medications. People simply wanted medications to help them sleep. I didn't have any of that. And so how do we utilize the psychiatrists that volunteered? How do we utilize people who are best able to treat the long-term needs? And so how do we partner with the leadership, both political as well as, you know, the people with the Ministry of Health, to then reestablish healthcare delivery in the country of Haiti? How do we continue to, deliver and meet the needs of the people? And so we have a team that's going next week. We've had a team that subsequently returned. Dr. Alan Richards was part of that team. And so we continue to look to the future to partner with other medical organizations in rebuilding Haiti's medical system.
Okay. Well, I'm Alan Richards. I'm a head and neck cancer surgeon. So you might think, what would a cancer surgeon like me doing in a place that's just been devastated by an earthquake? Well, fortunately, I had some general surgery training as well, so I've handled a lot of trauma in my life, so I felt that I could do it. And they asked for volunteers, and I thought, well, maybe this was my opportunity to do something meaningful in my life and something that I could do before I got too old to do it. So I volunteered to go down to Haiti. We flew in there. I was in the second group from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And we arrived there on the 11th of February. That was about a month after the earthquake. So things were very different to what Dr. Logie and Dr. Lee had seen a few days after the earthquake. We arrived at the city of Port-au-Prince. The country of Haiti is on an island which they share with the Dominican Republic. Haiti's on the left side of the island, on the west side, and the Dominican Republic on the east side of the island. Haiti's a U-shaped country, and right in the middle of the U is Port-au-Prince, the main city, which is a city of 2 million people. Cuba is about northwest of where Haiti is. You could almost see Cuba if you stood on the shore. The earthquake epicenter was a few miles west of Port-au-Prince, but the devastation affected most of the country. As was said earlier, a lot of buildings were destroyed, and this wasn't only near the epicenter, it was right through most of the country. So certain towns were completely annihilated and flattened. There were 12 of us in the party, myself and another surgeon. There were a couple of PAs, there was a pharmacist, and a number of nurses. I met a guy who worked for the United Nations, and his job was to go and retrieve bodies from the rubble. He said they just took truckloads of them out of there. It was just he just burst into tears when he told me. We flew out from Miami to go to Port-au-Prince. We arrived there and were taken immediately to the MediShare Hospital. This is run by the University of Miami, and it's a hospital, a tent hospital, on the runway in the main airport, on the side of the runway. There's four tents and a few small pup tents as well, occupying about 3 acres with a fence surrounding it, and is protected by troops from the 82nd Airborne Division and the U.S. Air Force. In fact, the United States has about 23,000 military personnel on the island currently. Equipment in this hospital was donated from right all over the United States, and the equipment is all kept in a big tent, one of the four tents. And no place for modesty, because there were men and women all staying in the same place. Outside they had some porta potties, and they had some showers where you could have ice-cold water showering on you. You were protected by a wooden barrier which showed your legs from the knee down and showed your shoulders from your head from the shoulders upwards. So once again, no modesty. The food was not very plentiful. We ate mostly what the troops ate, which are MREs or made ready to eat, and bottled water. The second tent, which is the ward, the adult ward, which has 170 beds in it. Once again, the same sort of beds that we slept on, 170 patients in there. In the next tent, this tent was subdivided into two. The one half of it was where the ER was, which was two little clearings just outside the tent, and then you walked into a 60-bedded pediatric ward, and then through a partition into the operating room area. On your right, as you got into the operating room area, was this area, which was cordoned off, and this was the intensive care unit. A lot of sick patients on ventilators, oxygen supplied by those oxygen cylinders there, which sometimes ran out, and we had to rush with a truck to the United Nations or other places to try and beg for oxygen. So we had to compromise quite a lot. But generally, the patients survived, and they were seriously ill. There were four operating rooms separated by partitions, no air conditioning, no sterilization as we know it here, quite sophisticated anesthetic equipment in the background, but the operating table was just a wooden table. You couldn't adjust it or anything with a plastic sheet over it. Operations we did, we had to get a nurse to hold a flashlight to shine into the belly or wherever we were working so we could see what we were doing. So that was a little bit of a trial for us, coming from a very sophisticated scenario up here in Omaha. So I spent about a week there, and we dealt mostly with patients who had were recovering from trauma, wound care, and then we got patients with who'd been shot in the abdomen and stabbed, and women delivering babies, C-sections, and things like that. Then they asked me to go through and spend a few days at the General Hospital, which is the city's main hospital. And we drove through Port-au-Prince on our way. And Port-au-Prince is really almost totally devastated by this earthquake. You said about, I think, 60% of the buildings were destroyed. To me, it looked like 90% of the buildings were destroyed. There were hardly any normal structures left. And they told me it was because the buildings have been constructed with a type of local cement quarried from a mountain nearby, which is poor quality and crumbles very easily. As I said, prior to the earthquake, there was a high unemployment rate. People wouldn't stay in any brick or dwelling as such. They were too afraid. So these 10 cities sprung up all over the show. This is the one in a clearing, but some of them were on traffic islands. A lot of them were just on the sidewalk, and people had tents. The lucky ones actually had tents. The ones not so lucky would have sheets and bits of plastic spanned across metal struts just to provide them some type of shelter, and they would sleep on the ground. Sanitation, not very good, so infections could be a problem there. Their washing, and that was done on the roadside and the sidewalk. Haiti actually became a republic when it broke away from France. It used to be a French protectorate. Broke away from France in 1804, and it was the second oldest republic in the Americas, second only to the United States. And it's the longest. This is the Black Republic, which has been present for the longest in the whole world. The dwellings and houses are built on the hillside, and these just crumbled completely. Nobody lives there anymore. Some of the restaurants have interesting names. I've never heard of a restaurant called Christ Loves You, but there must be a very nice, warm feeling inside that restaurant. The United States donated some school buses, and these are used for transport. In fact, the United States has made huge donations to Haiti already. Dr. Lee mentioned the USS Comfort. This is a U.S. Navy hospital ship. It has 1,000 beds and 11 operating rooms. And this is moored in the bay area there. They cannot actually use the harbor because that's not properly functional at present. So if we had anybody who needed any serious orthopedic surgery, the Air Force were very kind, and they took the patient across in a helicopter, and they got their treatment there. Spent a few days at the General Hospital. This had been wrecked by the quake. Most of the buildings were unstable. The wards are now in tents in the hospital property, and there's a strong military presence to maintain the order. So they need a lot of help, and the president of Haiti is working together with our president. President Clinton and President Bush went across, and they're working out a whole plan of development for the country so they can bring something out of the ashes. Thank you.
Thank you. First question we have, we're going to direct this to the Creighton physicians. Did you feel unable to take proper care of some people because of lack of resources, et cetera?
Well, there was a general lack of resources, and we were able to get move people out. What was more important was the number of people that we were able to help, that we were able to dedicate resources to. So, for example, majority of the traumas that we saw were orthopedic in nature, a lot of open fractures. They required amputations and things like that. That did not require x-rays, and we did not have x-rays. And then after that phase was done, we had an enormous number of patients with fractures who got pinned and whatnot. Again, without x-rays. So it wasn't optimal, but considering the primitive conditions and how early it was after the earthquake, we worked with about 800 patients that first week. And I have to say, I think that's pretty remarkable, even though we were there.
This is for the UNMC physicians. Could you describe your relationship with Haitian officials and if any, you had any problems?
I didn't have any problems. I don't think any of us had any problems with Haitian officials from the time that we landed on the ground until we took off. I was at a hospital in particular where they thought it had actually collapsed, and so the 82nd Airborne began to patrol the area where we were at. I think that sort of the beauty that has come out of the situation, or the blessings that have come out of the situation, is the relationships that were established while we were there. And so I do know that the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, who also happens to be from Haiti, has gone to Washington, has the UN on board in terms of how do we continue the medical education of the medical students, the nursing students who are left. How do we, ensure that those people become physicians and are able to treat the population of Haiti while we're there? So I think that we didn't experience any problems, but we certainly have some very few fruitful relationships that have been developed with officials in Haiti.
Hey, this is for the Creighton physicians. Could you describe the emotions you must have felt in treating the individuals that were so badly injured?
It's hard to describe. I think we all, I think when we got there, you felt overwhelmed. I think no doubt about that. And I think after that, if you ever, and we all did, at any point sort of stop and think about what was going on, that, your initial response is, this is horrible, this is terrible, what's going on, and then you kind of shut it out and stop. You kind of almost want to dehumanize the situation and try to put that out of your mind to sort of help you kind of get through what you need to do. But, it's overwhelming. These are all people. These are, like I said, these are people with families. These are not the Haitian patients that we saw. They were professionals. They were, doctors, lawyers, reporters, dentists. These were very important functional members of society with very strong, family lives and a high regard for family and other people. And these are, you felt horrible for them. This is just the same as happening to people, the people in this room. These are, it was really very kind of overwhelming. It was very, it's hard to explain. It's just the magnitude and the scale of it and the absolute suffering that I think was going on. But I think at the end, what really shone through is the strength of the Haitian people and their immense ability, I think, to look after themselves, look after other people, and to maintain a certain amount of dignity and composure in a very, very difficult situation. They're very spiritual people too, and I think that is a big part of what helped them through this the horrible crisis that they're going through.
This question is for both Creighton and UNMC. How long were you there, and how did you know it was time to come home?
Well, I'll speak now. I was there for 10 days. And how did I know it was time to come home? Well, I hadn't had a decent shower or a shave, and it felt great to get into a shower and stand there for half an hour when I got home. It was really good. Have some nice home-cooked food. I kind of missed that, and my family. But I felt sad leaving there because I wanted to do something, and I wanted to do more if I could.
Well, for Creighton, we were down in the field for a week. We got to Santiago Saturday. There Sunday, we left following Sunday. But that was because we had people rotate in from Creighton. We had a team of predominantly nurses and some physicians. And then we'd had an intermediate team that was down. Matt, for example, in pharmacy had organized a pharmacy. And quite honestly, we had battlefield conditions, and people were beginning to fray. And with the new team coming down, I felt it was important to pull people from the field, and that's what we did.
Thank you. Next question. Can any panel member talk about cooperation or lack of between the various medical groups and individuals on site, relations with foreign medics, i.e. Israelis?
I had quite a bit to do with that working at the General Hospital. Because there were doctors from, just to give you an idea, from Argentina, from Brazil, from India, from Israel, from Spain, Norway, Switzerland, England, South Africa, United States, Canada. So there was a huge, like the United Nations of doctors there. And they weren't very territorial, in fact. They were actually very friendly to each other, which is surprising, particularly for surgeons, because they're really narcissistic. And... being one myself. There was a good feeling of cooperation there and a lot of friendliness. The Israeli doctors arrived there with a big transport plane, apparently a day after the earthquake, and set up a field hospital there. I never saw the hospital, but I saw an Israeli doctor at the general hospital, and we got chatting, and it was quite a friendly atmosphere.
I encountered the same thing at the community hospital where we were at. We, just to add to your list, we had Koreans, South Koreans came, and we even had a Jamaican contingent there. Several, you know, of the small islands sent people there. So there was a great deal of communication. And the only time that it became a problem was in terms of the language barrier. So teams that sent enough people that they could function as one team, and if they didn't necessarily speak English, worked better as a team. But there was a great cooperative effort to get our community hospital up and running.
Well, from our side in Humana, we did encounter people from multiple countries as well. And I can't tell you that everything was rosy and wonderful. It absolutely wasn't. But we were working in a situation. It was a battlefield situation, essentially, and initially very, very chaotic. And there were clashes. But I think that what was important was that everybody basically had to pull together, get the oars in the water, and we all had to play in the same a sandbox if we were going to get things done. And for the most part, that's really what happened. And so I take away more of the cooperative efforts and the good that went on rather than some of the inevitable clashes.
Yeah, I think some of the early issues when we first arrived was probably because there wasn't a system or an infrastructure in place when different teams were arriving. So, of course, every team that arrives has sort of got their own ideas of what needs to be done and how they ought to do it. And coupled, we did have a language issue as well. The way we broke down, mostly the day staff was English-speaking, and most of the night staff were probably Spanish-speaking. But even then, you know, when you're trying to hand things over from one team to another and you don't speak the same language, you don't speak the same language fluently, it can be a little bit difficult sometimes. It just adds to the challenge of getting things done.
Particularly when the chart is in Creole, French, English, and Spanish. We definitely had charts that were in four languages, depending on what shift was taking care of the patient.
Next question. Have volunteers, upon returning home, experienced any form of post-traumatic stress, and how do you readjust?
Surgeons are used to a stressful life, so of course we're not affected by that kind of thing. I felt quite okay afterwards. I sort of fitted back into my usual daily routine. I found it didn't produce any stress disorder with me.
Well, we knew that we were coming into a special situation because it was only a few days after the earthquake, and we encountered a massive number of very badly injured people that had not received first aid or analgesics, and it truly was a scene from hell. And it was a very devastating emotional scene. And one of the reasons that we were at the end of the week, you'd ask about pulling people out. I pulled people out on Sunday, and one of the reasons for that was so that we could get back to Santiago Sunday evening. And then we had arranged for airplane transport to get back on Tuesday. We spent Monday basically together as a group. We recapitulated our experiences, and then we worked with Father Johnson to talk about a lot of the emotional aspects. And I think that was very, very important for us to do and to analyze the sort of in the terms of consolation, desolation of what we had experienced. And so I think that our group has done well so far, and I don't think. But I think the early groups then really encountered such a different situation. The combination of the just absolute devastating trauma, lack of care the patients had received, the extent of the suffering was unbelievable.
Because news media interest has waned, is there concern that less is being done for people so much in need? Panel.
Well, most definitely. You know, there are obviously earthquakes that are occurring in other parts of the world and things that are sort of overtaking the situation that happened in Haiti, but the magnitude of the damage and the magnitude of the psychological as well as physical damage to each of these human lives, the amount of lives that were lost, definitely, you know, requires us to keep the Haitian people, the survivors, in our hearts, in our minds, in our thoughts, in our prayers, and, you know, certainly those of us that have the means in our checkbooks. You know, you don't necessarily have to go in order to help, you know, any little bit of help through prayers, through donations, through fundraisers, people being creative in the ways in which they can help and can sustain the institutions such as the medical center that have committed to the long-term development of Haiti is really, really important.
When I arrived there, I commented that I didn't see a single sign showing that the American Red Cross had done anything there, and I was a bit upset about that. When I met that man, Steve Gillespie, from the International Medical Corps, he told me that the $200 million which had been donated to the American Red Cross, the Red Cross had actually given to the IMC, and they were going to use that for development. So it is being put to a good cause. So donations are really most welcome and can do a lot to help build up the country again.
Okay, this is going to be our last question, and this is for both institutions. And that is, what are your plans, your future plans in Haiti? Do you plan to return, or just, you know, what are your plans?
Well, Tommy, right.
I'm going back on Saturday, so.
Okay.
Yeah, it's part of it's. I mean, the situation there is changing, and I'm going as part of a transition team, transitioning from sort of acute trauma care to what this hospital I'm going to was originally built and used for elective surgery or elective general surgery, and they're trying to transition it back. So I think needs are changing, but yeah, I'm going back this weekend.
You know, based on what we encountered when we were there, I felt very strongly that as the situation was addressed further, that they should be enticing people to come out of Port-au-Prince to support communities outside of Port-au-Prince. And I have been urging Creighton, I believe, we will support the Jesuit Relief Services that have established at least six communities outside of Port-au-Prince that hopefully will become self-sufficient, the communities with education, because this is a long, long-term a building process. And really, I think there was some a projection of a 10% risk of another earthquake like they just had within the next year. Port-au-Prince is still just a disaster waiting to happen, and I really think offloading Port-au-Prince makes an enormous amount of sense.
I often tell people that Haiti is one of those places that you can never visit just once. And so definitely we have a team leaving on the 21st. One of the individuals who was on the very first response team from Haiti is going back. And so I think that all the members that went on the teams that have gone and said eventually they will go back. So.
Yeah, one of the surgeon that I was with, he's actually going on this 21st as well. Myself, I'll see how things go, but I might go later on this year. And everybody's talking about going again. As Yemi said, you get that kind of a attachment to the place. And nice to go back and remake acquaintances and so on and try and do something there.
I'd like to thank these physicians for taking time out of their busy schedules to participate in today's forum. One other note I have here is to thank you for all that you've done and that you continue to do for the country of Haiti.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. We've heard a panel discussion on the topic, A Touch of Local Caring, Haitian Earthquake Relief. The members of the panel from Creighton University Medical Center and the University of Nebraska Medical Center recently returned from Haiti after spending time there providing medical support to the victims were from Creighton, Brian Logie, Professor of Surgery, and Tommy Lee, Assistant Professor of Surgery. From the University of Nebraska, Oloyemzi Odugbizan, Instructor of Anesthesiology, and Alan Richards, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology and Head and Neck Surgery. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 15, 2010, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, May 20th at 12 noon. Patrick Bonnet with Nebraska Taxpayers for Freedom and Brad Stevens, Nebraska Director of Americans for Prosperity, will talk about the National Tea Party movement and attempt to debunk many of the myths and lies which have arisen about the movement. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.